John, share your remarks.
Got it. Thank you, Bradley. First of all, I'd like to give you a little background in how I got interested in the subject. And it was really an outcome of my incredulity of what I was seeing happening in the news south of the border over several years. But that in combination with COVID, when everybody was confined, and couldn't do anything else but stay home, I had space to think through what was going on here. And I thought, I'm a psychoanalyst. I should be able to come up with some psychoanalytic ideas, theories to explain what was unfolding in such a rapid way south of the border. So, the result of my researches in the subject was this paper, which John is going to screen share with us now, I think, and I can present it to you. Right. So if we go further, go down to the introduction paragraph, John. Okay, start there. The connection between psyche and polis has been examined as early as Plato's Republic, where he suggested that the culture of the polis is determined by the externalization of the essence of the individual psyches of the populace, and that the individual psyche is impacted by the internalization of the polis culture. The study of the culture of the polis will shed light on the issues that impact the individual psyche. Yeah, by the way, I will be primarily talking about Donald Trump's dynamics from my perspective, but other leaders like Bolsonaro, Berlusconi, Duterte can fall into the same kind of rubric. It is an incontestable fact that Trump had been attuned to the issues that were meaningful to the polis, and in a masterful way had used his persuasive abilities to sway public opinion. Trump has been labeled many things by the media, but they miss the point. Trump is neither a narcissist nor a moron, nor a compulsive liar, although he betrays elements of these quotes diagnoses. I consider him to be a master hypnotist who has mesmerized a significant portion of the American populace to accept his hypnotic suggestions. From this perspective, his self-proclamation of being a genius likely has some merit. His genius lies in his ability to analyze the culture of the polis and use his insights to sway public opinion and forcefully interject his message into individual psyches. Now, a little review of the literature, the psychoanalytic vortex. While the use of hypnosis as a technique for the treatment of patients was the earliest approach to the psychoanalytic cure, dating back to Bernheim and the Nancy School, by the late 1890s, free association had replaced hypnosis as the preferred psychoanalytic technique, and analysis of the transference was considered essential in resolution of repressed unconscious conflict. But the impact of hypnotic suggestion on the individual psyche continued to be avowed even after this shift in technique. Freud continued to acknowledge the impact of hypnosis on analytic theory and technique, quotes. It is not easy to overestimate the importance of the part played by hypnotism in the history of the origins of psychoanalysis. From a theoretical as well as from a therapeutic point of view, psychoanalysis has at its command a legacy which it has inherited from hypnotism. Ferenczi's important work, Introjection and Transference, links hypnotic suggestion to transference, providing insights into the underlying dynamics of the hypnosis and hypnotism. In this rich and incisive work, Ferenczi outlined his vision of personality growth and development based on the processes of introjection and projection. Early parental object relations are introjected, resulting in growth of the personality and the basis of future transference relationships with external objects as these internal object representations are projected onto significant others in the experiencing of external object relations. These transferences then are based on the quality of the early childhood environment. Maternal transference is characterized by the desire for acknowledgement of the mother's love for the child, while paternal transference involves the fear of father's wrath and submission to his authority. These are two basic approaches that hypnotists use to influence their subject. The promise of providing the gratification desired by the subject, or threat of danger if the subject does not do as instructed. The hypnotist encourages a regression to early childhood experience where a larger-than-life authority has the power to fulfill the child's wish or to threaten the defenseless child with harm. Ferenczi suggests that there are two broad categories of subjects amenable to suggestion: transference hungry, neurotic, who seeks to interject the idealized maternal object slash hypnotist, and the fearful, paranoid person who projects the feared internal parental authority figure onto the hypnotist. In this dynamic formulation, the hypnotist is not the actual active agent in the hypnosis. Ferenczi states, "The curious authority with which we as hypnotists dispose of all the psychical and nervous forces of the medium is nothing else but the expression of repressed infantile impulses of the hypnotized person. The hypnotist is attuned to the transferences of the hypnotized person and their infantile impulses, and uses this awareness to influence the subject with hypnotic suggestion. To accomplish this end, the hypnotist does performance act, where he takes on the role of the idealized, omnipotent mother figure who can fulfill infantile needs, or the powerful phallic father figure who can protect the child from imminent danger." Ferenczi further explored in his analysis of adults in this paper, Child Analysis in the Analysis of Adults, that regression to a childlike attitude where the analyst induces a trance-like state in the analysand and hypnotic suggestion is possible. He considered this deep analysis important in achieving resolution of the neurotic condition, but he cautioned the analyst against abuse of this passive receptive situation. Quotes, "In analysis, it is not legitimate to suggest or to hypnotize things into the patient, but it is not only right, but advisable to suggest them out." Chris, the paper he wrote during the Second World War, pointed out that psychoanalytic technique was initially based on principles of hypnosis in the latter part of the 19th century, but shifted to the pursuit of self-awareness, psychoeducation, and ego control after 1900, and the publication of Interpretation of Dreams and within its relation to the unconscious. In the same paper, Chris elaborates on the theme of hypnotic suggestion through World War II propaganda, and considers that the psychology of persuasion represents a reversion to the hypnotist slash propagandist inducing a trance-like submissive state of mind in the subject. He explained this phenomenon as a willing suspension of disbelief and a regression in the service of the ego. Chris studied this latter phenomenon in an earlier paper. He proposed that appreciation of wit, caricature, and the aesthetic represented a regression on the part of the ego to a childlike primary process state of mind where rational thinking is elided and the imaginary is given free rein. The caricature represents a throwback to an earlier childlike delight in modes of expression when the child was assigning meaning to words, images, and sounds in a transition to a more rational secondary process thinking. In the hypnotic trance state, the reasoning adult has regressed in the service of the ego to indulge in irrational primary process thinking, and like the impressionable child, passively obey suggestions made by the parental authority figure. Next section, we go on to dynamics of crowd and mass psychology. The modern day study of hypnotic influence of the leader on the crowd can be traced to Gustave Le Bon's The Crowd, A Study of the Popular Mind. Chris reviews his work critically, concluding that Le Bon had written his work more as an instruction manual to the military elites to manage crowds. He writes, "The function of propaganda is to drive the crowd into submission and to promote its regression. The attack upon reason under various disguises is paramount. Let the audience be tired, the lesson be repetitive. That all depends on the propagandist's conviction. The goal is ultimately to establish a relationship between the audience and the leader akin to that between hypnotist and the subject." But Chris points out that the regression experienced by the crowd is a temporal regression and not a universal feature of crowd dynamics. Ultimately, the crowd disperses and the individuals may recover their more adult ways of thinking. Freud commented on LeBon's work in his 1921 work, Group Psychology and Analysis of the Ego, and concluded that identificatory processes among the individual members of the group and the leader were essential in defining the culture of the group and transmitting a sense of the leader's power, which in turn empowered the individuals of the large group. Freud distinguished between a spontaneous crowd coming together in a shared cultural paradigm and the mass, which is structured by the group's shared ideals. Beyond his 1961 work, Experiences in Groups, discusses the dynamics of basic assumptions groups. He suggests that under adverse external conditions, the group regresses and that the leader is chosen to work with the group's basic assumption. The dependency group relies on the leader to provide for the members' basic needs. The fight or flight group relies on the leader to protect the group from external threat. The pairing group uses Oedipal romance that two members or a member and a leader will couple and produce a messianic leader that will lead the members to a paradisical return to the good old days when wishful thinking ruled. In Beyond's vision of group dynamics, the group members shared their experience in a projective identification process with the leader. In this sense, the group influences the leader to fulfill his role in containing basic assumptions that guided the group. In the dependency group, the leader provides a sense of security, certainty, and belonging. In the fight or flight group, the leader identifies danger from an external threatening group and provides protection from the danger. In the pairing group, eroticized connections between members and the leader animates the group. In a mutual communicative projective identification, the leader senses and fulfills the role assigned to him or her. Over time, there may be flux in the basic assumptions depending on external conditions presented to the group. Under varying conditions, different aspects of the leader's personality may be emphasized. Narcissistic, paranoid, Oedipal. It remains uncertain whether the leader is chosen because of his personality features or whether the leader's personality is malleable and adapts to the mass projective identification. Soriano, in a great book she wrote, 2018 book, was present in Brazil during the 20-cent spontaneous uprising in the streets of Rio and wrote of her experiences both as a participant in the spontaneous crowd ethos and a psychoanalytic researcher analyzing the underlying dynamics of the crowd. She suggests that Ferenczi's ideas in a little-known work, Analysis of Comparisons, sheds light on the libidinal investment of the individual in the group. The individual recognizes aspects of his own past experiences in a symbiotic fusion with the crowd and the individuals in the crowd. And the individual has a tendency to rediscover what is loved in all things in the hostile outer world. Elaborating on Ferenczi's ideas, Soriano suggests that the pleasure of resemblance, the pleasure of repetition, and the pleasure of rediscovery are at the basis of the individual forming social bonds and realization of the similarity with the other in the crowd. The pleasure of analogy is a recognition of a relation between two relations, which then becomes the libidinal ground of the social bond. Memory wounds shared by the crowd are rediscovered in a collective memory of past trauma and relived in the uprising. The repetition of past trauma, even transgenerational, and an airing of past repressed grievances represents an attempt at healing in the collective experience in an uprising with like-minded others. Volkan suggests that under traumatic conditions such as social unrest, economic collapse, natural disasters, the collapse of traditional social and cultural structures, leads to a mass existential crisis and group regression. The sense of alienation results in a search for a leader that provides the regressed group a voice that restores their sense of identity. A sense of identity, values, commonality, and security. The large group blindly rallies around a leader who creates a new group identity and ideology, with the good adherents obediently following the leader, while the group's bad adherents oppose the leader. Kernberg, a 1920 paper he wrote, I'm sure this had to do with what was happening south of the border. Kernberg suggests a dynamic formulation concerning large group regression. Faced with sociopolitical adversity, the large group regresses to a more primitive level of psychic functioning, using splitting, projective identification, denial, idealization and devaluation, and omnipotent control in attempting to contain psychotic anxiety. Splitting results in a polarization in society where the good followers of the leader are protected and are entitled to preferential treatment, whereas the bad outgroup members are demonized, suppressed, and dehumanized, becoming the object of aggressive attacks by in-group members. The leader is idealized while any who oppose him are devalued. His idealized status results in his being endowed with moral superiority, while the group is freed from moral constraints to act out aggressively against the devalued and dehumanized group. The reality of socio-political and economic turmoil is denied in favor of a return to a paradisical good old days feeling of grandiose inflation. The regressed group experiences a reduced cognitive level of functioning and responds positively to slogans, caricatures, and crude, sadistic expressions of animosity towards the outgroup. Jingoistic terms can quickly result in group regression to a trance-like suspension of disbelief and embracing the reality offered by the charismatic leader. Now, what I call the Trump phenomenon. From this psychoanalytic overview, we are now in a position to shed analytic light on what I call the Trump phenomenon. What the world has witnessed in the USA in the past, well, I wrote this 5 years before, can only be described as a phenomenon, as by definition, its cause or explanation is still in question. Furthermore, Trump can rightly be described as a remarkable person, a second definition, Oxford English Dictionary. He has exerted an unprecedented persuasive influence on a large portion of the population, and continues to mesmerize his followers as if they were puppets on the stage, and he was a puppet master. Whereas Scott Adams calls him a persuasion artist, I would go one better and call him a master hypnotist. He seems to have an innate ability to cast a spell on his audience and have them believe his version of reality. It is not so much a matter of persuading an audience rationally in debate, but having them take in his message and be convinced of its veracity. This is a typo, didn't notice that. If there is resistance to taking in the message, he redoubles his efforts or doubles down on this message, forcefully pushing it into the audience. Dynamically, this is what LaPlanche describes as implantation in the former instance and forced intromission in the latter. Whereas implantation into the other uses subtle seduction as technique, forced intromission uses gaslighting as a modus operandi. Hypnotic elements in Trump's technique. Having meandered through selective psychoanalytic theories of hypnotic effect on individuals or groups, I will now offer a construction of how Trump uses various elements to spin his hypnotic message in the minds of his audience. One. Inducing regression in the service of the ego with a projection of a maternal or paternal transference onto Trump. He promises to make America great again. America first. repatriate American jobs. Alternatively, he is the great protector, build the wall, stop the caravans, bring peace to the Middle East. His audience is enthralled by a larger-than-life authority who will fulfill their childhood dreams and protect them from outside aggressors. Two, slogans. Making his message simple is appealing to a majority of the audience who are confused by the more rational explanations of complex political, economic, and social policies. The slogans referred to in point one are examples of his getting his message across using simple jargon. Three, caricature. Regressed audiences appreciate using wit to get a point across. Crooked Hillary, Sleepy Joe, Pocahontas. Caricatures his opponents in an unfavorable light that is hard to shake because this type of talk has emotional valence and a throwback to childhood type of baby talk that the regressed audience can identify with. Once his audience recognizes the caricature as something that they can identify with, they also identify with the bearer of the message and feel understood by him. Splitting the crowd into good in-group and bad out-group inflames the regressed audience to struggle against perceived persecutors. The media is the enemy of the people. The Dems are blocking legislation meant to improve the lot of the common person. Bernie is a lefty. The Dems are socialists. Are slogans that polarizes the audience and propagates a sense of danger out there that the leader will protect them, protect his faithful from. Gaslighting the audience. If his seductive measures are meeting resistance, he doubles down on his messaging, repeating false claims until the audience accepts his version of reality. He labels as fake news whenever the media says something contrary to his message. The media fact checks and finds his messages to be erroneous and calls them lies. But they are missing the obvious fact that he is not interested in reality, but in his hypnotic suggestion being accepted by his audience. If the media opposes his hypnotic messaging, he labels it as fake news. He was able to convince 75% of the Republicans who voted for him that the election was stolen from him, and he is a true winner by a landslide. Adams suggests that Trump, by the way, he wrote a great book called Win Bigly, very well written. Adams suggests that Trump uses various hypnotic techniques, cognitive dissonance, confirmation bias, and repetitive messaging in his persuading his audience to accept his version of reality. Trump's influence and his ability to mesmerize the populace remains a reality and a constant danger to American democracy. The most damaging impact on his ongoing hypnotic control of at least 45% of the American public was Twitter policy to bar him from using the platform after the January 6 uprising. Nevertheless, the Trump phenomenon is an indication that a charismatic hypnotist can significantly influence a large portion of the populace and bend the country to his will. This is a cautionary tale of how easily democracy can be compromised by someone who is capable of using hypnotic techniques. Now, I'm going to refer to some cultural tropes and expanding on the discussion. The alluring siren call. Having analyzed Trump's hypnotic method, we may now turn to the content of his alluring message and ask the question, why is this so seductive? What was the hypnotic message that compromised the rational thinking in favor of a hallucinatory wish fulfillment mode of psychic equivalence? What internal psychic reality was it that so many Americans had espoused as external reality? My first suggestion, thesis, transmission of trauma. Take this opportunity to suggest that a historical trauma that has remained unresolved in generations of Americans since the Civil War and that has persisted as a phantom in the psychic crypt of the collective American psyche has been reawakened by Trump's rhetoric. White supremacy and white privilege has remained an overt political trope in the South since the humiliation of Lee's defeat at the Appomattox. sorry, Potomacs. The rise of Ku Klux Klan, Jim Crow laws, segregation, and public lynchings have persisted until the late 20th century. The loss of the Civil War to the North was never acknowledged and hence never grieved. This history over 100 years, suggests that there is a generational transmission of unresolved trauma still experienced by large swaths of the American polis who continue to operate with the belief of white supremacy and white privilege. They are threatened with the specter of the white culture being overrun by caravans of thugs invading their southern border, by non-white immigrants threatening to dilute their pure white pedigree, by neoliberals and lefties destroying their capitalistic way of life, and by ambitious Afro-Americans who threaten to take their jobs. These modes of thinking may have remained as unconscious fantasies or suppressed beliefs, but given voice by a powerful persuader, it has become a clarion call to almost half of the American population. Second trope, promise of nirvana. But one may well ask, what is it about Trump's hypnotic messaging that makes it so alluring to the entranced public? It is not just the message, but the voice and the cadence of the one delivering it that lulls the rational mind to sleep and awakens a more primitive emotional aspect of the listener's experience. Trump's rhetoric reawakened a sense of omnipotence, an imaginary wish fulfillment that had lain dormant in the deepest layers of the psyche since the infant had forsaken the imaginary for the real experience early in psychic development. Ferenczi suggests that the infant's earliest mental experience is a sense of unconditional omnipotence, and that its basic needs are automatically fulfilled through hallucinatory wish fulfillment. The infant, after the rude awakening from his hallucinatory slumber, is confronted by the frustration of its omnipotence by harsh reality and must forgo the paradisical pleasures of hallucinatory wish fulfillment, but longs to return to the initial blissful situation in the womb. Trump promises a return to the good old days and the realization of the paradisical America where the imaginary wish is fulfilled by a strong man who would make America great again. Furthermore, he would protect his followers from the dangerous outside world and threaten to destroy their imaginary paradise. His message has resonated in the minds of a large portion of the polis, yet it did not have universal appeal, and another large segment of the polis retained their rational adult mode thinking, opposing the illusory paradisical vision in the voting booths and on the steps of the White House on January 6th. Ordinary Joe Biden and Twitter CEO Jack Dempsey played the roles of Orpheus and Odysseus, respectively, in countering Trump's siren call, as I will demonstrate in the next section. But democracy's narrow escape from despotism is an indication that a significant portion of the American polis is vulnerable to hypnotic suggestion and possible future assaults by charismatic leaders proposing alternate realities. The poem in 1917 by T.S. Eliot, Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. I have heard the mermaids singing, each to each. We have lingered in the chambers of the sea, by sea girls wreathed with seaweed red and brown, till human voices wake us and we drown. Eliot's cautionary tale depicts the fate of those that followed the siren call into the chambers of the sea, the trenches in World War I. Written in 1917, during the worst of World War I, it was likely a reference to the millions of youths enthusiastically following the call to arms and meeting their doom in the trenches. The dreams of glory and victory quickly dashed as they awoke from their reverie only to face the reality of the killing fields. The American patriots who stormed the White House on January 6 may not have faced bullets, but their illusion of restoring their charismatic leader to power were equally dashed by the resistance of true patriots defending their democratic institutions, thus preventing the demise of democracy in the USA and the installation of an authoritarian regime. So, how to resist the siren call? Again, we can look to cultural tropes. Orpheus doing with the sirens? Orpheus was a mystical high priest of music who accompanied Jason and the Argonauts on their journey to capture the Golden Fleece. On their journey, they had to sail by the Isle of Sirens, who were reputed to lure sailors to their deaths on the rocky shore with their siren songs. Orpheus duelled musically with the Sea Sisters, Anne Roe, in 19, beautiful book, 2011, Orpheus, poetically describes a contest. The sirens meant to lure Argonauts there to die, leaving their bones to molder on the sand. Their music, like Orpheus's, contained divine ratios and the harmony of the spheres. It seemed as beautiful to the untrained ear, but it led only to oblivion, the earthly sleep of the soul. Their songs stroke tirelessly across a man's skin, wave after unguent wave, suggesting that we might see, touch, feel, love. The fascination of death by sensuality and by distraction. Even Orpheus was overcome. His body seemed to be dissolving, to be entered by softly beating sound waves, to be losing breath. Lily soft hands of song caressed him in a way he had never felt, never imagined. He might faint away here, his body falling along the rail and sliding into the sea. He did not care. But Orpheus struggled to find his voice. His first notes fought for him, small glittering rips and slashes in his silken shroud, until he was breathing, gasping, almost free. His music became a bone blade, a hail of bright stones flung at the swaddled water, scimitars of light. Finding his voice at last, it was his mother, Calliope the Muse, who prompted him. Orpheus sang of the lives of ordinary men and their heroic exploits in language to the crowd that the crew recognized, thus breaking the siren's trance. We may surmise that the siren songs and the hypnotist's alluring message promise a paradisical experience and lulls the mind to sleep, distracted from the reality of death by sensuality. Orpheus is shaken out of his reverie by his muse mother and finds his voice, drowning out the irresistible divine harmonics of the siren songs. Our latter-day unlikely Orphic hero is Sleepy Joe Biden, who successfully drowned out Trump's siren songs with his Ordinary Joe's message. Biden did not pose as a godlike figure making hollow promises to get elected, but as an ordinary, plain-speaking person that a majority of the American public could identify with. His ordinary song was one of the silent majority that the silent majority recognized. He would say things like, "Come on, get real. We're going to believe this bullshit artist." He spoke their language, waking the majority up to realize that the promised glitter and gold to make America great again slogan was nothing but smoke and mirrors that created an illusion of greatness, but ultimately led America down a disastrous path during a critical time of climate crisis and the COVID pandemic. A generation of Americans brought up on cultural fare like The Wizard of Oz were initially dazzled by the wizard's great power, but ultimately recognized that he was just a snake oil salesman, turned their backs on him. Second trope, Circe warns Odysseus. Odysseus had another method of dealing with the sirens in Homer's Odyssey. Cautioned by the sorceress Circe about the murderous sirens, she directed Odysseus to have his crew and himself block up their ears with wax once close to the siren's isle. Odysseus, curious to hear the siren song, had his crew lash him to the mast while they blocked their ears. When he heard their song, Odysseus frantically tried to loosen his bonds and join the sirens who bewitched him with their singing. This trope suggests as an antidote to the siren song, Odysseus' method of silencing the voice of the sirens was effectively done by Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey in canceling Trump's accounts. Without the megaphone of his bully pulpit, Trump was silenced. But this occurred only after a near coup at the Capitol. Those who had followed his siren's call were confronted by those who had blocked their hearing Trump's siren song. And when the bewitched awoke from their trance, were drowned in a sea of legal proceedings they faced consequently, as Trump abandoned his followers to their fate. Discussion. Donald Trump represents a phenomenon whose causality and meaning remains poorly understood. He evokes a visceral reaction from both his supporters and detractors, which compromises rational thinking processes in both camps. The media and the Democrats dismiss him as narcissistic and compulsive liar, while the Republicans and a large portion of the American public emulate him as a strong man who will bring back the paradisical good old days and protect them from hordes of foreigners outside and outsiders who threaten to overrun them. In this paper, I have attempted not to arrive at dynamic understanding of the man himself, but to understand the dynamic interrelationship between Trump and the culture of the populace. Specifically, what was his technique in being able to influence the dynamics of the polis? I propose that he was actually attuned to the repressed or suppressed wishes of a large portion of the populace, and he used hypnotic techniques in seducing or gaslighting the audience to regress to more emotional reaction based on imaginary wish fulfillment and return to the good old days. Alternately, he created a non-existent crisis of being invaded by hordes and caravans of foreigners, casting himself as their savior by building the wall. He transmitted his hypnotic message at his well-staged rallies, his Twitter account, and by the intense attention that the media paid him. Trump was also attuned to the phantoms of transgenerationally transmitted post-Civil War trauma, appealing to far-right white supremacists and those feeling entitled to white privilege. Many who stormed the White House bore the Confederate flag in a symbolic gesture of having brought down the Union forces. Cultural tropes were useful in considering what strategies may be effective in resisting the hypnotic messaging of the siren call. The role of Orpheus dueling the sirens was played by ordinary Joe Biden, whose plain speech and calm messaging broke the spell for many. The Odysseus method of blocking out siren song was Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey when he canceled Trump's Twitter account. But the fact that such a large portion of the populace were mesmerized by the Trump phenomenon suggests that mass hypnosis will remain a dangerous modality of influencing the polis in the future, not just in the States, but elsewhere. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Andre. I'd now like to invite Ian Miller to share his reactions to Andre's remarks.
Okay. Okay, are we going to have the text on the screen? Ah, there it is. This is called Third Thoughts because it follows Second Thoughts, which came 2 years ago, Pseudo-Reality Between Hypnosis and Spectacle. The discussant's role is to integrate and expand upon presenters' comments. However, following our Ferenczi webinar, now long ago in ancient history in September 2021, I felt uncomfortable in recognizing that having staked out our turf, which Andre calls the Trump phenomenon, we had done what was sufficient, but unfortunately not what was necessary. However, cheered by the aspirations of Winnicott and beyond that we'd been good enough in making the best of a bad job, I sensed nevertheless that something was missing. Remembering back to clinical training, I realized that what I sought approximated what ego psychoanalytic supervisors had termed a complete interpretation. I wondered whether it might be necessary to cast a wider net, more greatly integrative of the social sciences and the humanities, to better understand the dynamics recognizably perched upon Ferenczi's observation of the reciprocal actions of psychological projection and introjection. The present repetition of my Trump phenomenon discussion is constructed in three parts. Part one repeats my original discursive segue from Andre's and Robert Prince's presentations back in 2021, linking literary association to Thomas Mann's Mario and the Magician with the Trump phenomenon and its hypnotically fixed alternative realities. Part two consolidates occasional thinking over the next 3 months, originally connected only dimly to the necessity for rewriting my presentation, but is consolidating second thoughts, partaking of what W.R. Bion recognizes the imperative of time in the incubation of clinical intuition. Bion cites the Septuagint Ben Sira, writing that the wisdom of the scribe depends on the opportunity of leisure. These then were published in the American Journal of Psychoanalysis. Part three today is a brief, if bleak, commentary penned last week after several hours of reading daily newspapers from around the world. By circuitous route, connecting Bion's comment with a similar aspiration within practical philosophy stated by the first century Stoic Seneca, that the first sign of a settled mind is that it can stay in one place and spend time with itself, I consider that the essence of therapeutic practice from Seneca to Bion, both in writing and thinking, is the discovery of who one is, both relative to others and in the particularized context of one's life. This orientation, fundamental to psychoanalytic inquiry, radically challenges the hypnotic oblivion of the Trump phenomenon. It also stands in direct opposition to the easy allure of contemporary opinion, the focus of philosophical address for over 2,000 years, and today the substrate of our facile social media cultures. Keeping in mind the opposing compass points of psychoanalysis and Trumpism, I realized through my association from Bion's reference to the Septuagint from his New English Bible that I'd also linked two distinct historical periods 2,000 years distant. These linked Greco-Roman civilization to postmodernity. Specifically, Bion's reference from the Wisdom of Ben Sira or Ecclesiasticus parallels a similar Hellenistic aspiration fundamental to Seneca's practical philosophy. Translated into our contemporary psychoanalytic vernacular, we recognize this as the capability to contain wild thoughts generative of emotional tumult while maintaining a stability of mind. Seneca's letters portray Nero's Rome as a period of state-encouraged cruelty and torture, much as in today's period of American carnage, itself a term coined by Trump in his 2017 inaugural address, as if to sanction violent public intoxication with the power of spectacle, defined by my high school dictionary as something remarkable, especially unusual or grand in public display. As the correlate of spectacle, American carnage delivered in multiple ways, from the murderous car attack of the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally, to the caged incarceration of migrant children at the United States-Mexico border, to the reshaping of civic conduct norms linked with the political actions of the Supreme Court and Congress, all supplemented with Trump's constant Twitter feed of annoyance and protest from his totalistic and foreclosed perspective, with other opinion and scientific fact relegated to fake news. Reflectively unsure of such wild thoughts, I was heartened by Andre's reference to Homeric epic. What I sought required the same kind of net cast by Andre and Robert Prince, the provisioning of psychoanalytic dynamic contribution with the feeding of mind through imaginative humanistic reference to history, sociology, and culture, as well as classical and modern literature and approximation to fact that seems at least temporarily plausible. So here are my original discussions. Dr. Prince's concluding reference to the short story Mario and the Magician, written by Thomas Mann in 1929, provided an excellent bridge to my short discussion of his and Dr. Korotar's papers. Narrated retrospectively by a family man chastened by his own experiences in the event described, Mario and the Magician is roughly divisible into two parts, both repeating and intensifying its underlying themes. The first part articulates the social dynamics of othering and group extrusion under fascism by presenting the binary of Italians as Southern and Germans as Northern. The second describes the powerful splitting and intergroup dynamics of leader and led, using the voluntary attendance by a town's populace at a magic show, conscious of their desire to seek entertainment in a harrowing and forensic depiction of submission and rebellion to totalitarian authority. Nothing of significance is lost for the psychoanalytic reader if we begin with the final sequence of this well-known short story, when following his public humiliation by the magician, Cipolla, the somewhat abstracted, mild-mannered waiter, Mario, shoots his momentary master in cold blood. Mario and the magician narrativizes the hypnotic trance and recapitulates the malignancy of hypnotic suggestion popularized by the character Svengali in Georges de Maurier's 1893 novel Trilby, in the relation between a manipulative, filthy, hatefully racialized Jewish hypnotist and his naive, Gentile female subject. Freud, writing of hypnotic phenomena in his group psychology, states, "The hypnotist asserts that he is in possession of a mysterious power that robs the subject of his own will, or, which is the same thing, the subject believes it of him. This mysterious power, which is even now often described popularly as animal magnetism, must be the same power that is looked upon by primitive people as a source of taboo, the same that emanates from kings and chieftains and makes it dangerous to approach them, mana. The hypnotist then is supposed to be in possession of this power, and how does he manifest it? By telling the subject to look him in the eyes. His most typical method of hypnotizing is by his look." Of course, the psychoanalytic couch, while a remnant of hypnotic technique, strains against this approach by its forced aversion of the analyst's face from the patient's sight. And Ferenczi's model, detailed in Introjection and Transference, would recognize the action of hypnosis within the relation between external projection and internalization. However, 20 years after Ferenczi's paper and 8 after Freud's group psychology, Thomas Mann's cautionary tale suggests the totalitarian object, which was written about by Thomas Schebeck in 1996 and 1998, internally conjoined and externally demanded in fictionalizing the Italian fascist rise. From this perspective, Mario's externalization of the repressed emotional constellation partially revealed as love is now freed in murderous hatred, with its momentarily lustful, now murderously transferential focus on the magician. Mann takes pains to describe Mario as dreamy, distracted, somewhat unfocused, but he's also called primitive, underlining his suggestibility, and the awareness of primitive affects suppressed by the forces of cultural accommodation finds no better example than in the person of this amiable cafe waiter with delicate hands, delivering chocolate, coffee, and delightful dessert confections to the middle-class summer vacationers on the Italian coast. But central to Mario's rage is public humiliation, first in public revelation of his heretofore unspoken erotic love for a woman, and next in the homosexual act of killing the magician, of kissing the magician, my slip, who had hypnotically seduced him. While externalization of the repressed may be humiliating for Mann's hypnotic subject, today's political climate operates with greater complexity. The barely repressed hatreds and condemnations of what André accurately links with Ferenczi's observations on hypnotic relations between leader and follower needn't be the sole focus of the subject's repudiated consternation. Indeed, as Prince articulates relative to Trump followers, in shameless public display contradicting traditional norms of decorum, as reflected in the January 6th Capitol insurrection, of excusal and condemnation of clear thinking and fact, and a primitive hatred and sexualization, with the fantasies of mastering and destroying others as objects of distracted pleasure, leading to Simone Weil's own progression in force from demonization to dehumanization to non-being. These go beyond the scope of Ferenczi's clinical recognitions, except possibly in the daily processes reflected in his renowned clinical diaries. Mann is himself self-consciously clinical in his forensic attention to process. Several times his narrator apologetically explains to readers that he's lost the exact sequence of events. Not only does Mann document the step-by-step activity of the magician with his audience, but earlier, through depiction of a social slight to the narrator's family, documents the shift from expected hospitality to enacted minor cruelty. And with the reception of such behavior, the narrator's own attitude to family and others in his interpersonal field shift, seemingly without notice. Most critical is the narrator's interested but distant position as observer to nightmare, explaining to the reader in self-exculpation several times that he'd attempted escape from the morbid intensifying dominance of the totalitarian object, exemplified individually and in the social group, but had remained, however vicariously fascinated. Not only through the arrest of thinking, but also in the paralysis of action, Mann foreshadows social breakdown. In closing, four considerations elaborated Andre's and Bob's paper relative to Mann's story. The first is our clinically developed attention to the momentary and significant changes developing within psychosocial process, focused through this panel on hypnotic relations between leader and follower. These are strongly contextualized by cultural history. As illustrated by Daniel Boorstin's 1961 observations, the American national addiction to a fascinating and omnipotently expected, always disappointing entitlement has reigned culturally for decades, inclining us all to a disappointing and solipsistic fantasy world antagonistic to consensual reality. The second is that submission to totalitarian authority may not be entirely hypnotic. It may also be conscious and willed, filling an emotional absence suggested by Mann relative to Mario with a certainty of authoritative conviction. The third concerns difference between the leader who humiliates his followers and who, as Dr. Prince noted of Trump, projects their felt humiliation onto hated others. Using Mann's example under the scenario, veneration of such a magician is likely only to continue. In sum, we must pay attention with Thomas Mann to how changes in both spectators and opponents of the Trump phenomenon are necessarily determined by internalized political, legal, and sociocultural enactments under this leader-led relationship, and however vicariously we are all affected in Trump world through the delusional substitution of reality by what is more accurately symbolized in fantasy, the dangerous events of political myth honed by fantasy, projected externally and enacted as behavioral fact. And now my second thoughts on the Trump phenomenon. Daniel Boorstin, historian and Library of the United States Congress 50 years ago, arrived at a significant cultural idea powerfully addressing today's confusions that purported alternative realities. Boorstin in 1961 argued that through both manufacture of physical consumer goods and the generation of images, such as orchestrated, televised political press conferences, Americans are externally cultivated through corporate and political marketeering, clothed as factual, to believe imaginary pseudo-reality. Boorstin concretizes what Edward Bernays, the father of public relations, applies to advertising, his uncle Sigmund Freud's ideas of unconscious desire, wishful and fantastic, through the production and marketing of goods and ideas intended for audience consumption. Boorstin, like Bernays, articulates the seductive offerings of popular culture to its American audience. He describes America's receptive, acquisitive cultural idea of fantastic expectation an entitlement to gratification that is necessarily incomplete in its delivery. In so doing, he exposes the corporately cultivated underbelly of American cultural desire through the grooming of individuals' narcissistic impotence. Like Burger King's 1970s advertising mantra, have it your way. Such targeted entitlement operates to inflate entitlement, compensating for emotional hunger, but leads only to further enticement for greater consumptive demand. Less than a decade before Trump's election, Chris Hedges in 2009 documented the addictive triumph of orchestrated American spectacle in papering over the emotional impoverishment resulting from Boorstin's pseudo-reality while supercharging its fantastic promises across multiple foci, including reality television, the phenomenon of Las Vegas, the pornography industry, positive psychology, and world wrestling entertainment with which Donald Trump was involved. Spectacle delivers. It extends Thomas Mann's political observation of incipient fascism in Mario and the Magician to capitalism's materialist imperatives. Even therapeutic healing is distorted through this orientation, as in President George Bush's exhortation in the wake of 9/11 to pursue shopping as emotionally reparative. Hedges argues that such orchestrated and heavily marketed spectacle gratifies its audience through emotional release from the confines of reality by means of participants' imaginary identification with someone other than themselves. Following Freud in 21, in light of Andre and Bob Prince's papers, this is identification with the leader or who one might oneself become in fantasy through pursuing a given directive, writ large and valued as cultural idea. Throughout, whether Bernays, Boorstin, or Hedges, the pseudo-reality of societally cultivated seduction seeks individual internalization via the route long ago explored by Ferenczi. The Trump phenomenon proves its success in the certain domain of anti-thinking, heightening human callousness and cruelty to others in acquisitive, stimulative pursuit, a parallel to Seneca's mediation on the effect of murderous Colosseum crowd behavior upon his well-practiced equilibrium. Affected by Roman spectacle, even the archetypical Stoic was flummoxed. And that's in section 1, page 35 of Seneca's letters. Through Hedges' lens, the narcissistic injury observed by Boorstin in the emotional depletion of consumptive culture is overridden by the gratifications of promised and delivered alternative realities. Such subjectively elective pseudo-realities, whether offered directly, as in the wrestling arena, or mediated electronically through social media, promise immediate gratification as their immediately powerful residues dissolve doubt and skepticism. Returning to Andre's Homeric example, it's as if Ulysses were to remove the wax from his ears and encourage his crew to visit the sirens, soft-pedaling murderous consequence. Historically, addictive popular adhesion to spectacle is not new. Seneca describes crowds cheering human slaughter in the Roman Colosseum with screams of, "Kill him! Whip him! Burn him! Why is he so timid about running onto the sword?" He also reflects that the unconscious internalization he undergoes is profound, writing, "Do I come home greedier, more power hungry, more self-indulgent? Worse than that, I become more cruel and inhumane just because I've been among humans." Seneca's stark choice still illuminates our time. In his exhortation towards self-reflective practical philosophy, such that you should not imitate those who are bad because they are many, and neither should you become hateful to the many because they're unlike you. Retreat into yourself then as much as you can. Spend your time with those who will improve you. Extend a welcome to those you can improve. The effect is reciprocal, for people learn by teaching. Hedges' spectacle operates against the Senecan ideal of learning through reading, thinking, and teaching, with the eclipse of American literacy reflected in President Trump's regular communication through the impoverished, if strangely telegraphic, vehicle of X, formerly Twitter. By contrast to spectacles, populist seductions, not unlike the vicarious gratification detailed by Mann's narrator in Mario and the Magician, thinking about the contingencies of action ceases. Spectacle feeds the mind with the junk food of thrill, coupled with fantasies of power, control, and violence. It dissolves not only the capacity to doubt, fundamental to productive intellectual inquiry, but also the Senecan and Bionian requirement to contain one's wild thoughts, feelings, strivings, with the allowance and time to pursue their taming by reason. To conclude these second thoughts on the Trump phenomenon, return to Ferenczi's 1909 model of internalization. Not only is this dynamic foundational in its observation within clinical psychoanalysis, but also within its operation in the realm of spectacle. But our contemporary fascination with spectacle extends beyond the butchery and circuses of Seneca's Roman Colosseum. Guy Debord observes of contemporary spectacle that it interrelates and explains a wide range of seemingly unconnected phenomena. The apparent diversities and contrasts of these phenomena stem from the social organization of appearances, whose essential nature must itself be recognized. Considered in its own terms, the spectacle is an affirmation of appearances and an identification of all human social life with appearances, but a critique that grasps the spectacle's essential character reveals it to be a visible negation of life, a negation that has taken on a physical form. Spectacle requires a consensual parataxis, a perverse cultural transformation whereby old-fashioned consensual reality is extended into pseudo-reality of manufactured images, of which Debord observes, when the real world is transformed into mere images become real things, dynamic figments that provide the direct motivation for hypnotic behavior. That is, the Freudian reality principle is confounded with the pseudo-reality principle, the condition for Prince's observation of contemporary delusional alternative realities. Further, such dynamic figments, uncoupled from the reality principle, themselves cultivate society's hypnotic appetite, behavior passively adhesive to external demand, freed from the ego constraint of reflective thinking. This then becomes the fertile ground upon which André's observation of Trumpian hypnosis unfolds among a population cultivated since birth in confounding their own being and rational thinking with seductive appetitive appearances. The choice is stark, fundamental to the thinking necessary to cultivate both democracy and individual freedoms from oppression and toward generativity. Opposed to spectacle and epitomized in psychoanalytic method, such leisure to think leads toward the toleration of uncertainty and doubt, with the possibility of productively evolving self-formation. This had been Ferenczi's therapeutic aspiration. Diametrically opposed to the containment of uncertainty and doubt, the same internalizing dynamic continues to operate and to be observable both individually and within group behavior within our participations in spectacle, leading toward delusional servitude under the fantasy of the impoverished self's omnipotence. And now the third part from last week, a coda. All of this, our delusional servitude under the fantasy of omnipotent power, is in full daily view. The foreground fact of increasing pressure from climate change, including climate-related patterns of forced migration, as well as the increasing prominence of social conflict and ongoing war, herald a change in public opinion. What is mine, defended aggressively, becomes the norm. Xenophobia, bullying, and violence become tolerated as the scope for compassion, empathy, and kindness contracts. Anti-colonial wokeness as well as right-wing nativism operate as cousins at poles of the political spectrum. One can observe communal regression to primitivism among other Western states. The United States, Germany, the United Kingdom following Brexit, and Israel are indicative of this cultural coarsening. W.R. Bion long ago commented upon zigzagging ideas seeking germinative minds within group culture. These ideas, originally suppressed or unconscious, are today on the rise and made acceptable at the level of opinion, heightened by the tinsel gravitas of social media, with opinion itself always highly suspect in the mind of philosophical thinkers for over two millennia. The Trump phenomenon in its upcoming 2024 return demonstrates the mindless sleepwalk into this dangerously regressive moment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ian. So let's take our 5-minute break now, then we'll reconvene and begin our discussion period.